Welcome to this week's edition of the Third Opinion Podcast. We've got part two of our interview with the ADL about rising anti-Semitism and what you can do about it. And we recognize the place the last out in this year's World Series will play in Jewish sports history. Don't forget to subscribe to Third Opinion wherever you get your podcasts. Here's this week's Third Opinion.
Good afternoon, or good morning, or good evening, whenever you're listening to this. This is the Third Opinion, Two Jews, Three Opinions, the podcast, and on WKDW, and we are delighted you are with us. I am Mike Deason.
I am Lorene Jaffe.
And my throat is a little scratchy today, so I'll apologize in advance. I've got some kind of cold or allergies or whatever it is, and on this day that we're taping it, it's raining like crazy in Tampa Bay. But we've got an exciting show for you today, I think that the thing that I'm most excited about is our part two of our interview with Lonnie Wilkes from the ADL, who is going to talk about social media and anti-Semitism and anti-Semitism on campus, which is a major, major problem.
And we, and as you and I know, we've had so many guests on talking about it. I think most recently, we had a guest on from the Lucy Brandeis Institute, who his organization in Washington, D.C. actually specializes in representing students and teachers and others on college campuses who feel like they're being discriminated against. We know that it is definitely on the rise, not just here in the U.S., but in Canada and around the world. It was actually a little bit of a disturbing week. I mean, there just seems to be a lot of stories of the rise of anti-Semitism. And Mike and I have a clip we're going to play for you in a little bit, because we're coming up on the anniversary of one of the most horrific pogroms in modern time, in Kristallnacht, on November 10th. And, you know, I think understanding the history of anti-Semitism, understanding the history of pogroms, that wasn't the first, that this is something that had been going on in Eastern Europe for some time, is really important to understand and to put things in perspective when we're looking at the rise of anti-Semitism again in Europe as well as here in America. It always looks the same, you know. It always sort of, everything seems quiet and peaceful and everybody's getting along, and then before you know it, it just overtakes and it overwhelms, you know, even, you know, the most quote-unquote civilized of societies. And
I think back to the insurrection on January 6th. There were so many anti-Semitic shirts and sweatshirts that people were wearing. It's really frightening.
It is. I mean, at the same time, you know, I don't want to label everyone there that was present at the speech on January 6th as anti-Semitic. We also know there were very large segments of the Jewish population that, you know, that came from New York and other places to be there, that were participating, that had absolutely no connection to that group of people that was wearing some of that. But
I mean, the ones that went to the Capitol, though, I have a problem with those folks, and a huge percentage were wearing anti-Semitic shirts.
And it's more than that. It's also the far left, the extremism, this what we're seeing, the progressive left, the far left. I mean, And what we're seeing, what you and I just talked about, that sort of expose we just did on mainstream media, it's ugly no matter where it's rearing its head. But the important thing is that it's everywhere, right? It's obvious when people are walking around wearing T-shirts or waving flags. What's not so obvious is when it's just being broadcast on mainstream media on prime time, or, you know, or just coming out of the mouths of politicians left and right. It's really, and we're seeing this, you know, around the world. I think even this week, you know, in Brisbane, Australia, you know, a peaceful community on Shabbat was in synagogue, and, you know, right across the street, a neighbor was, you know, waving a Nazi flag outside his window. And the crime for doing that is, you know, considered a public nuisance crime. I'm like, woohoo, you slap on the wrist for doing that, for trying to harass and intimidate Jews that were, you know, attending religious services on Shabbat.
You know, the problem, Laureen, is I mean that's Australia, and I don't know the First Amendment laws there, but even in the United States, it's a thin line. I think I've talked about this before. I grew up in Skokie, which is where the Nazis wanted to march. I don't know, in 76, 77. It was long after I'd left. I was out of college. And my dad and I would have these huge discussions. I call them arguments. Yeah. He said, no, they're just discussions. Because he thought they shouldn't be able to march there. And I said, Dad, no, we've got to let them march there. I mean, that's what the First Amendment is all about. It turned out they never actually marched in Skokie. But you've got to defend the right of the people to have speech that you abhor. It's easy to defend the First Amendment when you agree with what people are saying. It's when it crosses the line into violence.
Then it becomes a problem. Or even here, look, I mean, this is where I'm disturbed. You know, obviously, you know, Abbas, the leader of the Palestinian Authority, you know, was at the Vatican this past week meeting with the Pope. And, you know, and the Pope, in essence, is like, nudge, nudge, nod, nod. Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, let's not forget that the Vatican recognized the, quote, Palestinian state, which the world has not recognized yet. The state of Palestine in 2013. And then, you know, Abbas went on to give an interview to his local media after his meeting with the Pope. And in essence, you know, was telling the Arab world that, you know, that he was briefing the Pope on Israeli efforts to seize and destroy Palestinian and church property through fraudulent sales and all this, just like, just more, just creating more propaganda, more lies, more reasons for Catholics to hate Jews. Let's just continue with the blood libel. And then, you know, the
but I think in some, I mean, I've read some things that the Pope has said, who has pushed for a two-state solution, which a lot of people, including I totally believe that there should be a two-state solution. And I think that's part of it. And I think Abbas sort of turned what the Pope was saying into a PR coup for the Palestinians.
I'm not going to defend the Pope. I mean, the Pope shows up in Bethlehem and he criticizes Israel. I mean, you know, this has been going on for quite some time. I mean, let's not forget that Bethlehem, or Beit Lechem, as it's called in the Bible, it's actually means house of bread in Hebrew. It's where David, the king of Israel, was born. And it was a predominantly Arab Christian population until really the Palestinian Authority took control, I think, in 1994 of that territory, and the Islamic extremists harassed and forced most of the Arab Christian population out. I think it's less than 20%
now.
Yeah,
less than 20% now.
Right.
It was the majority before they came in.
That's right. And those who remain, though, are those that pretty much are in alignment and agreement with, you know, Abbas and their entire, you know, ideology and what they talk about, you know, Israel sort of being a cancer, et cetera. But I thought, you know, the other thing that really bothered me, too, this week is the International Committee of the Red Cross. You know, here in America, Red Cross, we think of it as sort of like this neutral humanitarian aid organization, but it's not. I mean, the International Committee for Red Cross has been known for many years when it comes to the Middle East, especially when it comes to Israel, of openly expressing biases. The president is very openly biased against Israel, and sort of spreads like these lies, like, we'll never condemn the Palestinians for, you know, using their children as shields or for terrorism and killing Israelis, but we'll openly condemn and attack Israel. And that's sort of, that goes to, again, it's like that quiet anti-Semitism. It's like, you assume that this is a legitimate organization, it's a good organization. Everybody's like, oh, they're humanitarian.
Well,
you never hear it. And then they sort of, these quiet whisperings, sort of openly attacking Jews for blood libel. And it's like,
spreads
anti-Semitism.
I understand that. And I think that the Red Cross, I mean, obviously does some very good things around the world, but you can't forgive the blatant anti-Semitism that comes out from the leadership there. But now, listen, I want to go to a happy thing. The names.
Let's do a happy thing.
Okay. Right. The names Max Fried, Alex Bregman, and Jack Peterson will live forever in Jewish and baseball history.
Ball history.
As the final out in the World Series. had Max Fried on the mound. He may be one of the second best Jewish pitcher. I mean, Sandy Koufax still goes down as the all-time greatest Jewish pitcher, maybe one of the greatest Jewish athletes. But Max Fried was there, and he was
pitched. That was so exciting. It was. Yes, yes.
So he pitches to Alex Bregman, and he hits a fly ball to Jock Peterson in right field. And so three Jews are involved in the final out of the World Series. So I thought that.
Because we don't really get to talk about Jews in baseball that often.
We don't talk about Jews in sports a lot. Yes, that's true. That's true.
So this is a very exciting game. I thought another really, fun, good and well-filled story this week. Lily Ebert.
Oh, man. This is great.
She's adorable. She is a Holocaust survivor.
97 years old.
I know. And there's a great story of her in the Times of Israel this past week, and she's pictured with her great-grandson, Dov Foreman. She wrote a memoir called Lily's Promise, and she and her son on social media, and she's on TikTok, and she's a huge TikTok sensation doing videos and educating people. She has over 100 million views. Go, Lily. And she's so excited to be educating and sort of spreading the news about the Holocaust and how she survived and found strength to live. And I'm so excited. They have millions of viewers, millions of followers, and I think this is amazing.
With
her great grandson.
Yeah, you ought to look it up on TikTok. But she doesn't say anything. There's captioning, and she's sort of dancing or doing whatever what it is. It is just, it's wonderful. If that doesn't put a smile on your face, and her attitude, and being a Holocaust survivor, is just so amazing. Speaking of the Holocaust, how about that auction going on in Israel? An auction house is auctioning off, I don't know what I guess the stamps or something that they used to put the numbers on the Jews that were taken into concentration camps,
and it's so gross.
It just sickens me. As I told you, growing up in Skokie, I had a lot of friends whose parents were Holocaust survivors, and we'd always look at the tattoos, it hit home even as a little kid, But the fact that they're auctioning this off is just. It's just
well. The good news, I think that the court, the justice minister, there was a call on the government to put a stop to stop the sale of it. So, because what it was the actual that was used in the Holocaust. These were the numbered needles, the stamps used to put the number on each person in the camp, and just so gruesome, along with the instructional brochure, et cetera, that went along with it from the manufacturer. And obviously, something like this belongs in Yad Vashem. And so I think the auction house was the Zolman auction house. I can't understand. And then Zolman's like, the good news about all of this is, and all the uproar is that it helped serve as an important reminder to the public about the horrors of the Holocaust. I'm like, okay, well, that's great. So there's a win-win situation. But the fact that you didn't put that up on the, it's just, what were you thinking? So the government, I believe, as of this morning, said no. It's horrible. Who would even want to buy that? I don't even understand. What sick person would be like,
something I want to have in my collection. Yeah, that's speaking of the Holocaust, we've got an anniversary coming up this week, depending on when you're listening to this. November 10th is the anniversary of Kristallnacht, when Jewish shops were destroyed. What was it, 1939, right? I think I'm right.
Homes vandalized.
Yeah.
People were murdered. I mean, it was just horrific. In the Jewish neighborhood, the entire neighborhood was just decimated. It was just a horrible, horrible crime. But not the first pogrom and not the last.
That's right.
So we're going to learn about that.
We have a piece, and I was surprised when I listened to this about the amount of Jews that lived in Poland prior to this pogrom we're going to tell you about. And they got along fine, and then all of a sudden the winds changed, and we suffered again at the hands of a cruel person who was only out to decimate the Jews. Let's take a listen.
Right.
In the 17th century, Poland held one-third of the Jewish population and was considered the center of Jewish life. Meanwhile, Poland's serfs were engaged in a revolution that gave rise to one of the most sadistic pogroms in Jewish history, led by a Ukrainian nationalist who, right up until the Holocaust, was considered the worst villain in modern Jewish history. He was so evil that the Jews nicknamed him Hmiel, the Wicked. As early as the 11th century, expulsions from Western Europe led Jews to find a new home in Poland. In 1264, the King of Poland offered his protection to the Jews, and by the 13 and 1400s, Polish kings actively encouraged Jewish settlement. The Jews became prosperous, trading goods across networks that stretched from Venice to Crimea, and holding leases on a variety of assets. Their religious life flourished too, and by the middle of the millennia, Polish Jewry was experiencing a golden era. But as they rose in prominence, the Jews also faced escalating persecution. In the mid-1300s, Jews were blamed for the Black Plague. In 1399, a rabbi and 13 elders were accused of destroying church property and burned alive at the stake. But these acts paled in comparison to what was ahead when stirrings of rebellion threatened Jewish stability in the region. In 1569, Ukrainian territory fell under Polish rule, much to the dismay of the Cossacks, an adventurous Eastern Orthodox people made up of runaway serfs, bandits, and traitors. The Cossacks created self-governing militias and opposed anyone perceived as a threat, including the Polish state. They hoped to one day free Ukraine from Poland's Catholic rule. 26 years later, Bogdan Khmelnytsky, the son of a low-ranking Polish nobleman, was born in central Ukraine. His mother, according to many sources, was of Cossack descent. By 1620, Bogdan had completed his studies at a Catholic college, and while many of his fellow students embraced Catholicism, Bogdan remained true to the Eastern Orthodox Church and his Cossack roots. Shortly after college, Bogdan entered into military service and quickly rose through the ranks of the Cossacks' military. Throughout the 1630s, national religious oppression from the Poles led to a number of small Cossack uprisings. While a free Ukraine was never far from the mind of a Cossack like Bogdan, he was generally not involved. Instead, he spent his time building a family and maintaining his estate. But everything changed in 1646 when a Polish nobleman laid claim to Khmelnytsky's estate. He sent a local official to harass Bogdan, damage his property, and violently beat his son. Bogdan did what he could to fight back, but despite twice pleading his case to the King of Poland, his property was ultimately seized. Fueled by this personal injustice, Khmelnytsky organized disparate bands of Cossacks and peasants into armies. Capitalizing on long-held discontent after years of persecution by the Poles, Khmelnytsky promised to liberate Ukrainians from the Polish oppressors and, because of his celebrated military career, became the rebellion's leader. On January 25, 1648, Bogdan led the Cossack uprising through Ukraine. At the time, some Jews were in charge of large Ukrainian estates, acquired by Polish nobility, and even given the responsibility of collecting taxes. Sadly, the Ukrainian peasants were fervently anti-Semitic and viewed Jews as an active arm of the oppressive Polish system. Rallying his troops, Khmelnytsky declared that Poland had sold the Ukrainians as slaves into the hands of the accursed Jews. One by one, Jewish towns were savagely destroyed. The first large-scale massacre took place in the town of Nemirov. They massacred about 6,000 holy souls in the town, and they drowned several hundreds in the water and with all kinds of severe torments. Another first-hand account relays, some of them had their skins flayed off them and their flesh was flung to the dogs. They ripped up the bellies of pregnant women, took out the unborn child, and flung them in their faces. By 1649, the golden age of Polish Jewry had abruptly come to an end. Bogdan Khmelnytsky's revolution lasted 9 years, and while it liberated Ukraine from Polish conquest, it is estimated that between 1648 and 1653, more than 300 Jewish communities were destroyed. Though there is still debate as to the exact number, at least thousands of Jews were killed, and some sources suggest that the death toll was as high as 100,000. The Jews who did survive were either forcibly converted or driven back to the countries they had previously escaped. In 1650, the Central Jewish Authority in Poland designated a new fast day to commemorate the worst massacre of the Jews since the destruction of the Second Temple. Against all odds, Polish Jewish life was slowly rebuilt. In cities such as Warsaw, Vilna, Krakow, and Łódź, Jews developed an extensive network of cultural and literary institutions, and Poland reclaimed its reputation as a center of Jewry.
You know, Lorene, we were talking earlier, it frightened me with the whole thing on January 6th. I still think we cannot turn our backs or close our eyes to the fact that things could go terribly wrong in this country. I mean,
I think they can. Yeah, no, I think that's right. I mean, look, first of all, Kristallnacht, just a quick correction, was 1938.
Oh, 38,
so,
okay.
Yeah, so it was 38, and I think, you know, what we missed was, you know, the government. Like, the Jews, again, were prominent, you know, and even the government, you know, different leaders in government have welcomed the Jews. One of the Jews is settled in Poland, when the Jews had settled in Ukraine, invited us to go there as we were escaping other, you know, attacks of anti-Semitism, you know, again, part of, again, the revolt and the kicking out of the Jews from England and Spain and everywhere. So one of the places that had welcomed them was Poland, and because Jews were educated and they were literate, and because they had to be able to read the Torah. And so they added that value to the society. But ultimately the backlash, and we see, and that's why, like, you know, it's not on one side. I mean, you've got these extremes all over, and you've got it on the left, you've got it on the right, it's coming from every direction. And I think that's what's so frightening. I mean, even this week, it was so crazy, which, by the way, before I move on to that story, just everybody, that was from the provider Unpacked, and we actually had them on about 6 months ago.
You're talking about the piece
Yeah, yeah. And they specialize in doing short educational video clips on everything you want to know about Jewish history, Jewish life, Judaism. And they have a YouTube channel, and they are so well done, so informative, so educational. I would encourage you, if you go on YouTube, subscribe to Unpacked, and just start, you know, browsing through and watch some of them. And we're going to play a couple more in the weeks ahead, but really super educational. But, you know, we're looking at, just this week, was it in France, you had the far left candidate defending the far right candidate, and both of them are anti-Semitic, and both of them make gross statements, and both of them are just, like, out of control. So you got this far left leader defending his far right opponent on anti-Semitism. You know, he was asked if he personally considered the far right candidate who was Jewish to be anti-Semitic, and so the far left candidate demurs by holding up Judaism as an intellectual basis for Zemmour's anti-immigrant, homophobic, and ultra-nationalist platform. He said Mr. Zemmour cannot be anti-Semitic because he reproduces many cultural themes. We do not change tradition. We do not evolve. Pluralization, my God, what horror, he argued.
You know, it's...
He's attacking Zemmour, who's also a Holocaust denier, who you know, is also anti-Semitic, but then saying, no, I don't, you know, he's pretty much defending the guy, saying all these traditions are very much linked to Judaism, which, of course, they have nothing to do with Judaism. But it's like they're so messed up, like, they're so screwed up in their own thinking that they, like, literally cross paths and defend each other. It's
we've talked about this. France is a dichotomy in the fact that we've talked about a lot of anti-Semitic incidents in France, but Macron has been stellar in his defense of Jews in France, and he has been a real friend to the Jews in France. But man, I it seems to me that if you're living in France, if you're a French man or woman and you're Jewish, life is tough in France. That's what it seems like to me.
Well, you know, that's why we've seen, like, when the highest waves of Aliyah in the last 10 years to Israel by Jews has been France. You've had all these French Jews, like, trying to escape and get the heck out of there, you know. And then, you know, this week, I've got to mention this, because Arizona State University, this was very upsetting.
Yeah, it was.
So Arizona State University, there are flyers being found all over the campus this week, in essence, blaming the Jews for everything again. Saying,
who controls the world is what they said, yeah.
And it answers, quote, Jews do, in a dripping blood font against a Star of David. It was posted near a kosher restaurant on campus this week at the University of Arizona in Tempe, Arizona. And I just, Jews control the world. It's like, I don't even understand, like, the secret cabal of Jews when, like, we're less than a fraction of a 0.5% of the world's population. And somehow, you know, we're responsible for everything. I don't really...
Yeah, it is hard to understand why there is such hatred for us. It baffles me. You know, I just don't get that. Yeah, another thing that baffled me. Did you see the German police basically mocked a memorial to Jews in Berlin, which I've been to. It's a stunning piece of stone that you walk through, people walk through in silence, just to commemorate and remember the Jews that died in Germany. It's just down from the Brandenburg Gate. And these police officers were doing push-ups on the stones there.
And they're videotaping it. And apparently it's not, apparently it's becoming a thing. Like, people are showing up and taking videos for their TikTok or their Instagram accounts, doing all kinds of things. They're just disrespecting the site. And it's like, why is that a thing? Like, I don't understand, like, why that's a thing. But I thought the other thing that baffled me this week, because, you know, we love the ADL here. Our guest speaker today, Lonnie Wilk, is with the ADL. The second part of his discussion today, but they've got a huge international conference that's going on right now, on Never Is Now, which is sort of ADL's tagline, Never Is Now, and they have an annual conference with one of their guest speakers, Saria L. Hirschborn, has openly accused Israel of ethnic cleansing, and she's a professor at Northwestern University in Chicago, which we know has had certainly in the last several years a rise of anti-Semitism on campus, and she's a professor on Israeli studies there. But I'm just surprised
she supports BDS. Yeah, I wish we had talked to Lonnie beforehand, and I'm sure it wasn't his decision, but.
No, but
I mean, what were you guys thinking? I mean, it just
do they know? Do they know? Like, this is a woman who sort of is part of the problem on campus, is spreading these false narratives that all it does is fuel hatred towards Jews in Israel. Like, a false narrative like that, it drives hatred. It gives people another reason to hate Jews and to hate Israel. And I don't understand, like, this teacher. And why she was invited to speak, and I wonder, I don't, you know, maybe she'll be disinvited, I don't know, but at least as of now, she's still invited, and I find that concerning. I also thought it was weird that Twitter, you saw this story.
Oh, yeah, this is the, yeah.
So Twitter's new editorial curation lead, she's a former reporter with Al Jazeera, so she's their new lead for Middle East and North Africa. Her name is Fadai Yassim. Was hired by Twitter, and so she was so excited, you know, announcing her new position about, you know, covering the Middle East, and she has all the flags there except for Israel's, and, you know, people are condemning her because they're going, look, you know, this is a woman who's openly, you know, has been tweeting and posting, you know, all kinds of stuff that's anti-Semitic. You know, we know that she has retweeted stuff from Farrakhan. I mean, it's just like, this is who Twitter decided to hire.
I know, makes, but you know, that's a perfect lead-in to our interview, which we've got to take a break before we go to that, and then we'll come back and talk about it, because we talked a lot about social media and anti-Semitism and anti-Semitism on college campuses. But let's take a break. This is The Third Opinion.
Third Opinion will be right back. We just want to take a moment to remind you to follow Third Opinion on Facebook and make a visit to our website, thirdopinionpodcast.com. Leave us a comment or suggestion there and listen to any podcasts you may have missed. That's thirdopinionpodcast.com. Let's get back to Third Opinion.
Welcome back to the Third Opinion Podcast, and I'm WKDW, Two Jews, Three Opinions. I'm Mike Deason.
I'm Lorene Jaffe.
Last week we talked to Lonnie Wilk from the ADA. He's the regional director for Florida. Fascinating guy. And the part of the conversation we're getting into in part two this week is the problem with social media. Man, you know, I'm on social media a lot, and I see some things that just make my head spin. I'm surprised they don't take it down, but you see it on Facebook. Zuckerberg is Jewish, but you see these horrible things. You see it on Twitter. You see it on all these sites.
The Supreme Leader of Iran is allowed to, you know, talk about, you know, blowing up and wiping Israel off the face of the earth, and nobody takes down his post.
That's right.
Somebody explain that to me.
It makes no sense. But we started off talking about the problem that's occurring on college campuses that the ADL found out through a survey they did. And here is Lonnie Wilk.
Yeah, and ADL has done polling both in the United States and around the world to gauge people's levels of anti-Semitism, how much they support a anti-Semitic canard. Jews have too much power. Jews control the banks. Looking at those stereotypical things, and we've seen over the years shocking amounts of numbers coming from those polls, and we then see the translation into anti-Semitic action. We just this past week, ADL joined with Hillel International, and in a poll found that about a third of Jewish students across the country on college campuses experienced some form of anti-Semitism, whether in person, online, whether it was directed at them, or a little more widely. So when we look at the impact and the escalation from rhetoric into action, we really have to look at societally at taking steps to interrupt anti-Semitism and hate.
Yeah, I saw that poll, as a matter of fact. One other thing that I'm distressed about, and we've dealt with a lot on our program, is the schism that's developed between the African-American community and the Jewish community. I went to college in the 60s, and Jews were part of the civil rights movement. We were right there, the March on Washington, and we were aligned because we were both discriminated against. It seems lately, and as I say, we've talked about it on the program, you've got that Farrakhan type of rhetoric that comes out, and there is... There's not a symbiotic relationship, it seems to me. How can we build that back? We're both trying to fight for the same thing, equality and justice for all people.
So let me dissect that a little bit, because there is a little bit of ways to look at and addressing the issue. But let's look at the question first. You know, we first of all, ADL. We are an organization with a mission to stop the defamation of the Jewish people and to secure justice and fair treatment for all. And we have, so when we say we, ADL is Jewish, is a Jewish organization, but we are an anti-hate organization. And we have strong ties and strong connections with the organized Black community around the state and the country. I think it's a little bit, it's not exactly fair to look at the individual instances regarding things that we've seen from individuals within the Black community that many people have been expressing concern about over the years and attribute it to the community at large. Similarly, if you were not within the Jewish community, there are individuals and some organizations within the Jewish community that have shared and said homophobic, anti-Islamophobic, racist things, and but we know that though they don't necessarily represent the large swath of the organized Jewish community, let's say. So it's not exactly the formula or the way that that might not match reality per se. What I would say is that we also need to look at the internally at the Jewish community, and have a real internal discussion, because we have many parts of the Jewish community that are not necessarily traditionally white. We have many parts of the Jewish community, the majority, if I'm not mistaken, of the Jewish population in the state of Israel descends from or is intrinsic to the Middle East or North Africa.
The Sephardic Jews, right.
Sephardic, Mizrahi Jews. We have Jews from a phenomenal community in Israel of Jews from Ethiopia, of Jews from India.
India, they just came, last week I think it was, they just came, a group came over or something like that.
Right. So I think the first step for us within the Jewish community is to really understand that we as a Jewish community are much more diverse. So when we go to relate to others, we don't necessarily, we might not find it beneficial or wise to present ourselves as monolithic when we're really not. The other thing that we really need to do is have conversations with leaders, with representatives in other communities, and ask questions and listen. We need to understand everyone else's framework. We need to understand the needs and dynamics of other communities, the way that they've experienced bigotry, the way that they've experienced xenophobia and isolation, what their chief concerns are, and listening to those experiences and having discussions one-on-one or in groups, those discussions can help us on the local level to really strengthen our ties. I think because of the fact that we live in this 24/7 social media culture where we see headlines from government and Hollywood seemingly all throughout our social media feeds and newspaper headlines, we can tend to look at that as interaction when really what's needed is interaction, human interaction between people on the ground locally, getting to know each other, building shared experiences. And when we find those commonalities, then we can say together, here are the issues that we need to tackle together, because our voices are not individually not going to move the needle. Together in unity, here are the issues where we can and must move the needle together. One of the big ones that ADL has been tackling and continues to tackle are hate crimes laws. And here in the state of Florida, we have a hate crime law on the books, which is good, but we have no hate crime protection for gender identity, or physical disability. And we recognized years ago that if we want to really impact the legislature in Tallahassee, we cannot necessarily do it alone. we need a coalition. So we've got a coalition right now of more than 340 leaders, organizations throughout the Tampa area, throughout the state of Florida, including by the way, the Tampa Jewish Federation. And we are looking to make sure that our hate crime law in the state of Florida is comprehensive
and covers everybody. That's great. You mentioned social media. I see a lot of hate on social media. Is the ADL jumping into that messy pit?
Not only are we jumping in, ADL has been really at the forefront of addressing bigotry online since the days of dial-up. We've been really working on this for decades now. And we actually are, speaking of coalition work, we have a massive coalition specifically regarding Facebook called Stop Hate for Profit, or Facebook now called Meta, apparently, called Stop Hate for Profit, where we are looking to pressure and leverage a massive coalition to really get Facebook to address the explosion of hate, of anti-Semitism on its platform. We even see issues with that platform addressing Holocaust denial.
Oh yeah, all the time.
And on various social media platforms, ADL has a Center for Technology and Society that is in Silicon Valley and connecting directly and working to make sure that all kinds of internet and social media platforms take a look at the ability of their own platforms to become super highways for hate and to take efforts to look at what they can do to mitigate hate and bigotry on those sites. ADL is a staunch supporter of First Amendment free speech without question. But we also strongly believe, especially in the private world, about the enforcement of responsible speech. And when we see hate and bigotry unchallenged, and when we see Facebook, Twitter, Gab, TikTok, all of these social media companies not necessarily taking the effort as seriously as they need to, we've been advocating for them to take action. And one thing that all parents and educators especially can do is if everyone goes to Google and just types in ADL Cyber Safety Action Guide, I highly encourage every educator and parent that I come across to put that in their bookmarks. It's a platform, a website that we created, which has a menu of various social media and internet platforms. It lists the hate speech policy, and it gives a link that people can use to report any issue on those sites, whether it's bullying, or in this case, cyberbullying, harassment. We need to make sure that those social media companies are receiving reports so that they understand really and take action against the bigotry on their platform.
And finally, I'm wondering if someone who is hearing this, and I hope they're moved by it, wants to get involved with the ADL to fight anti-Semitism. Tell me what they do.
So they can go to ADL.org or Florida.ADL.org and get involved. You can contact us through our website. But I would highly urge you, everyone, to go to, when you go to ADL's website, go to the Take Action tab. And you can find a myriad of resources there for students and for educators to learn and to how to have important conversations about bigotry and the best ways to combat it, about how to combat anti-Semitism. We need to, number two, we as a society, we need to be stronger in reporting hate. As I mentioned earlier with social media platforms, we also, I can't tell you how many times after the release of an audit of anti-Semitic incidents, we actually get phone calls or emails into our office from people who see the release, the reports, and say, we didn't think to contact ADL or to have our Jewish organization contact ADL. We didn't think this was serious, this incident, this thing that happened to me or to us. We can't address trends unless we know what the data is.
Fascinating guy. We got to have him back again. I really enjoyed talking to him. I thought he was really good. I thought
absolutely. I think, you know, and of course, and if you're a little bit curious, go back. You can also listen to Ken Marcus from the Louis Brandeis Center that we had on a couple weeks ago. You know, again, because if you are a student or you're a parent of a student or faculty that's, you know, facing some of these mounting problems, there is help. There are organizations that are there to help you because you do have rights. And I think a lot of students a lot of times feel very defenseless, but you do have rights. So make sure you take that up. I thought the other fun story, you know, because we talked about Jeopardy so much because we love Mayim Bialik so much.
Yeah.
But you sent me that cute story about another guy who was just on Jeopardy. I don't know if it's aired yet. I guess it aired on.
No, it did. It did. I saw it. Peter Stein, who is a Jewish documentary maker and filmmaker, and he was on Jeopardy. Jeopardy's big in our household. We watch it. And he was on, and he was just as pleasant and nice as could be, and they kept saying, he smiled all the time. He said he had a time of his life. He didn't win, unfortunately, but he did really well, and it was fun watching him. But I thought he was really cool. So it was a nice little thing this week. He just was a smiley guy, you know. How about
I think that is fun, and he's well let me do this one. So, because this is a Jeopardy question. So for you Jeopardy buffs, this country discovered ways to measure Jupiter's gravity field to yield information about the massive storms and jet streams that cause the planet's bands.
Okay, I'll buzz in. Yeah, what is Israel? Yeah, I know that's...
Yes!
No, but you know what they found with the red cloud that it goes down like 310 miles or something like that.
So crazy. I mean, that thing is just massive, this massive storm on Jupiter, which has been moving. I mean, it's amazing.
The red spot, on Jupiter. But those were Israeli scientists that discovered that, which is very cool. How about...
I know.
Okay. Margaret Taylor Greene this week, again talking about the Nazi shots. This woman... I mean, there was the Jewish space lasers and all. I mean, she's anti-Semitic. She's just...
Well, you know, I don't think she's anti-Semitic. She's just stupid. I mean, she says a statement. She says, I've made a mistake, and it's really bothered me for a couple of weeks. So there's no comparison to the shots in the Holocaust, and I've apologized. I feel, but, you know, she's, like, very apologetic for that. But then, you know, she wants to call the people who are you know, forcing... you know, people to get vaccines. She keeps wanting to call them Nazis. Now, okay, you know what? Call them dictatorial. Call them fascist. You know, you just, but don't, like, I understand why you want to use the word Nazi because you feel so strongly about it. You feel like these people are poor, but they're not. There's not a comparison, and it's no different than referring to it as a Holocaust. Like, find another word. Find the, like, evil dictators or whatever. I don't care. Like, whatever you want to use in your lingo, but, like, and it's not it's not any less offensive. And it's so frustrating. You know, she says they are fascists. They're trying to ruin our country. Well, okay, then just call them fascists, but don't go into the whole Nazi, you know, comparison.
I know.
And I think it's like this stupidity. And it's like this, whether it's the right or the left, people want to keep calling people Nazis. And it's like, just stop it, because it's like there's this total numbness now to that word in this country. Like, people, I mean, look, I'll admit, Mike, I mean, look, on Seinfeld back in the day, the soup Nazi, it was hilarious, okay? You know, Jerry Seinfeld had the soup Nazi on, and we all thought it was funny. And, you know, was it appropriate? I don't know, maybe not, but it was comedy, and it was light. And it was like one little thing. But, you know, today, it's like everybody wants to call everybody a Nazi, and it just...
It loses
the relevance.
And speaking of that, the Lincoln Project, which I really like, they're very democratically oriented and anti-MAGA, and they've done some great spots, did a bad thing in the Virginia gubernatorial race. They had some people dress up as Nazis as they were supporters for Glenn Youngkin. How stupid. And normally I support these folks, but they just stepped in it too deep. How idiotic that was. That whole race was, you know, Virginia. I worked in Virginia for 10 years, covered politics. You can only be governor for 4 years. You can't succeed yourself and then come back. It takes 2 years to learn what the hell's going on, and then your term is almost up.
You can't serve 2 terms in Virginia?
Not consecutively.
Really?
And yes, and that's why McAuliffe was running again, because he had been governor. He was term limited after 4 years, couldn't run, then he ran again. It's an archaic system, but, you know... It is really true. But that's how they are in Virginia. The old joke used to be, you know, how many Virginians does it take to put in a light bulb? It would be 100. One to screw in the light bulb and 99 to reminisce about how great the old light bulb was.
I have a positive story. Well, it's positive for me just because, you know, we've talked about how bad things are in, you know, in Britain and whatever, and how nasty the soccer fans, the football fans can be over there. So the Scottish Football Association finally has been slapped with a nice big old fine from the World Soccer Organization for their horrible behavior of their fans last month in that game against Team Israel, if you recall. I mean, and what was so crazy is they weren't all Jews on Team Israel. Like, they were Arabs, too. And, like, even one of the Arab players was physically assaulted. Somebody threw something at his face by a Scottish fan who was throwing stuff at them.
And they were booing during Hatikva.
I know. It's just
how disrespectful. Yeah.
So obnoxious. And I'm, like, so glad that they're getting, you know, that they're getting punished. I mean, these were the same... You know, people after the match, protesters vandalized Team Israel's bus, painting Palestinian blood, free Gaza, Zionism is racism, victory to the Intifada, end Israeli apartheid. You know, this is, and it's just like, look, you know what? You have a responsibility to control your fans and to stop that type of behavior. And unfortunately, it has been, you know, accepted behavior.
But Lorene,
for way too long.
You hear that music? That means we are out of time. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends about us. This is the Third Opinion Podcast on WKDW. I am Mike Deason.
I'm Lorene Jaffe.
Bye.
That's our podcast this week. Remember to subscribe to Third Opinion wherever you get your podcasts. Until next week, thanks for listening.